Welcome to a podcast on fire on Fearless Hyena and Infernal Affairs 3. One starts off his directing career. Another troupe is concluding their crime saga. We are therefore covering Jackie Chan's directorial debut, Fearless Hyena from 1979, and the finale to the Infernal Affairs trilogy, where we go back and forward. But there is a period put on the continuous hell theme in Infernal Affairs via the third movie. It all concludes here, and thus our coverage of it. And therefore, my name is Kenny B, and just because we needed a solid theme to at least the Infernal Affairs coverage, I bring back Phil G to help me conclude it after helping me starting it up with 1 and 2. So Phil G of easternfilmfans.co.uk, welcome, buddy. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Thanks very much for having me back.
Like, we can soon discard all this gloomy talk of continuous hell and stuff like that. But then again, it's been quite a joy to watch the movie stars and the storytellers do their thing.
Very much so. It's been an enjoyable journey into hell.
So soon we're back to crap on Island Town. There's plenty of stuff for us to do before we leave this mortal coil, Phil. Island Town crapping, number one priority.
Yeah, Island Town crapping.
I'm not going to leave until I'm done. In terms of that, I mean, there's no set structure to the Alan Tam shows, but there is a Lucky Stars movie where he is in, so that's a prime opportunity to talk of that, because My Lucky Stars is popular enough. That one, I'm not sure Sammo was in it a lot, but certainly it's the Lucky Stars gang and their tomfoolery and some action, and we'll see how Alan Tam fares within all of that. So that's one choice to do eventually, but that's for another show. Why don't you start us off with the plugging, easternfilmfans.co.uk. For people who do not know, give us a short blurb of what you do over there.
Yeah, so easternfilmfans.co.uk, also on Facebook and Twitter, which I regularly update, and we're all about the action, really, but anything that takes our fancy. But we keep up to date with the latest goings on in the martial arts world and the action world of Asian cinema.
What are you particularly chuffed about nowadays coming up? Maybe Donnie Yen and Vin Diesel in XXX 15, 6, 6, 3? How many of those movies? I don't know.
I'm a big Donnie Yen fan, so anything Donnie Yen's in gets my seal of approval. Shirt on or shirt off, bless him.
Are you following that, his big Vin Diesel movie that is in, whatever, XXX in order it is?
Yeah, Xander Returns or whatever it might be. They'll go off and do their Hollywood productions, and we'll follow those. But you know, I'm always keen on what they're doing back in, you know, Hong Kong and the Asian productions. Those are the ones that excite me more. They're the star of. They're just participating. Yeah, okay. You know, Vin Diesel's going to be the star of that. I'm sure Donnie Yen's going to get some decent screen time. But you know, Tony Jaa did it and stuff, and he wasn't really in the Fast and Furious that much. You know, he was there, it's never really, you know, taken off. I just want to see him busting some heads in on back 15 or whatever. Let's just get back to that. Let's get back to some martial arts frenzy action.
Yeah, they're doing it for different market and under different conditions. And if you're not a star, then they know that stuff, that it's going to be maybe different, not as much creative control, because it neither of those movies, if talking Donnie, Rogue One or XXX here, is it called XXX, or have I just imagined that?
It is. It's a series of movies, yeah.
And Rogue One it is. I mean, we're not kidding ourselves that this is the big Donnie Yen vehicle that's going to be exactly like everything you've seen in Hong Kong cinema. Obviously not, but I'm glad to see the exposure and that his career is on its third or fourth decade or something like that. 80s, yeah. 90s, it's fourth. His fourth decade, so he's got the staying power, that man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he's great, and he gets that, you know, he gets that publicity. And, you know, we're all about, you know, my site, Eastern Film Fans, along with everybody else, it's about getting that exposure to Asian cinema, to those films, to the genre that we love, you know, and to get that. And Donnie Yen being in those films will get that exposure, and people will pick up Donnie Yen films that they've not seen before. And the same thing that, you know, Jackie Chan's done over the years and stuff. I'm not the biggest fan of the Rush Hour series, you know, the Shanghai films. They're good films. I enjoy them. But I still prefer, you know, the Chinese films. So, you know, I look forward to Railroad Tigers when that comes out. You know, he peppers the Hollywood productions with the home stuff, and, you know, that's what I go to see. But yeah, it's all about the exposure for Asian cinema, and you know, that's great.
Which is very fair and very sound thinking on your behalf and all of that. So yeah, plenty to look forward to. But that's your plug done, and the rest of them goes as follows. This is Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network. Our website is podcastonfire.com, where you'll find plenty of choices in terms of what we cover on this network, whether it's Hong Kong, Japanese, Korean, sleazy, ninja, even bonus episodes. It's all there, and I hope you find something that suits your tastes. And if you have any questions or feedback, let us know at the following email address, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. And if you follow the handy buttons at the top of our website, the colorful, handy, big buttons for slow folks like me, you can reach us on Facebook and like our page. We have a link to our discussion group on there. We have a button on our website leading to our Twitter, to our iTunes feed. So if you're an iTunes user, please subscribe and get the podcast delivered to you that way. Leave a star rating and even a written comment. We would love to see some more up there. And finally, stream us on Stitcher Radio, which you can do via the website or on the applications available for free from the Apple App Store and Google Play. And I write about the variety of Hong Kong genre movies and Taiwanese genre movies over at SoGoodReviews.com, with a focus on adult movies, Taiwanese, specific Taiwanese sort of exploitation action genre style, rather than the art house stuff that's popular from Taiwan. Not saying that's bad, it's just not my cup of tea. Speaking of that, and speaking of action, I mean, you like out of Taiwan, like the big thing out of Taiwan, the big movie out of Taiwan, at least last year, was Assassin. And I mean, it is a wuxia per definition, but it's done by a director favoring, you know, more slower cinema, more contemplative cinema. And I just know reading reviews that it's never gonna be my cup of tea, his type of style. But it's wonderful though, because that people get so much out of that, that they get so much out of that, and there's never a middle ground with a director like Hou Hsiao-hsien. So yeah, you know, as an action fan, did that ever appeal to you, Assassin, or you sort of knew that maybe it's not your type of action?
Yeah, I followed it for a couple of years. In fact, I think 2 years ago it was on my top 10 to look out for that year film, and it took that long to actually come out. And it's sitting there. I can see it now on my shelf. I've got a copy of it to review and to look at. So I'm going to save my opinion until I actually watch it. I know that it's, you know, it's not going to be the all action martial arts frenzy that, you know, I enjoy. But because I know that, I'm probably going to enjoy it more because I know what the director's like anyway. And I know he puts together beautiful looking films, so I'm really looking forward to it in a different kind of way from the usual, you know, action fest, and I know that's coming. I think if I caught offside and I was going into it thinking it's going to be action packed, I'd probably be disappointed. But I know what it's going to be like, so therefore I'm looking forward to that.
Something new for the site, something new in style and tone and all of that. But regardless, my sort of Taiwanese preference is late 70s, early 80s, where they sort of some politically charged movies came out, but a lot of exploitation movies as well. They call them female revenge and things like that. And also a good, fun, short period before sort of drama and the art house cinema became more known in Taiwan with Ang Lee, Edward Yang, and Hou Hsiao-hsien. But that's anyway on SoGoodReviews.com, and my video hub for my spoken audio video reviews is on sleazykvideo.com, and my Twitter handle is at SoGoodReviews. So that's us for now. Let's hear a podcast promo break from one of our friends in the community, and after that we'll be back to review Jackie Chan's directorial debut, Fearless Hyena, from 1979. So yeah, sit tight and we'll be back.
If you like westerns, comedies, foreign films, horror movies, action adventure, and classic cinema, well, we don't have much of that, but if you like ass, titties, farting, burping, puffy nipples, poop, taboo porn, muffin tops, comic books, wrestling, mustaches, pie smashed on butts, cheese, taking baths, butt sex, gagging, milk, and the American flag, check out the Silva and Gold Podcast. We're the morons your mom warned you about while she was sitting on.
Silva and Gold. We talk about movies and shit. Find us on iTunes or silvaandgold.com.
And welcome back. And first review of this episode is of Fearless Hyena from 1979, and plot from the user Yaron on IMDb. Jackie Chan plays Chan, living in a remote village with his grandfather, played by James Tien, who's teaching him kung fu. He keeps getting into fights, even though his grandfather warns him not to show their kung fu to others. Chan, though, is tempted by some thugs he beat up to act as the master of a kung fu school. Or their kung fu school, perhaps. The school's name apparently spreads so far so that an old enemy of Jackie's grandfather shows up and attacks young Chan, and that would be Yen Shi Kwan's character of Yen Chun Wong. Yen Shi Kwan, viewers should recognize from Once Upon a Time in China, where he plays quite a layered and nuanced villain in that one. He's the one that Jet Li fights at the end of Once Upon a Time in China. And after he shows up, Jackie goes on training with the help of a member of an old gang until he eventually can get revenge because his grandfather is killed by Yen Shi Kwan. So yeah, the stuff of hundreds of kung fu movies, really. I mean, you don't need to write a plot for these kind of movies sometimes. Like, master is dead, revenge. Let's see what the content is like using that template, because it's not automatic doom, or is it? So let's throw over to Phil to let you share your short opinion, first of all, of Fearless Hyena. So go, Phil.
Did we just give away the plot line? You've just told him he's died. I can't believe it.
It's mid-movie, dude.
It's a generic, it's the generic movie. I must, you know, avenge my master, isn't it? You know, it's got all those elements that set Jackie Chan on the road to the, you know, stardom, as it were. And it zips along at a lovely pace. Fearless Hyena is the start of something you see within Jackie Chan that he becomes with his next movies, and gradually gets into that cycle. It's a wonderful piece of light cinema.
Seen it before?
Yes, many, many years ago. Again, it's great to revisit these films and come back to them with a fresh eye, with a older eye. Oh, my old eye. And think, are you going to enjoy it as much as you do? Because I do remember really enjoying it the first time around, really getting into it, climactic battle at the end, etc. And will I enjoy it again? So there's trepidation going back to something because you remember it so fondly. And will you still have that same enthusiasm? And I'm happy to report I still have that same enthusiasm for that movie.
You know what? I've had those examples across different genres over the years. Like, you know, take John Woo, for instance, which was my introduction to Hong Kong cinema. And then you watch all the very good ones that followed by other directors, and you watch all of the not very good ones that followed by other directors, and yeah. then you've seen so much of the genre. You've seen the genre being parodied even by itself, unintentionally even, and then you go back to the well and the good ones, and I'm exactly the same. I'm happy to report that those that were powerful still are powerful.
So
it's a good little tester for you. As for my short opinion, good, but a mixed bag. The earlier stages of the movie, both comedically and action-wise, sort of stumbles. He experiments here, but as he continues, he shows signs of increasing the complexity of action, of his ideas, and showing a highly tuned skill of delivering ridiculously complex action choreography, with the highlight being the finale, featuring a very bizarre style of fighting. So we'll get to that. Like, it's not even lame kung fu comedy, sort of. It's just bizarre, man, and it's wonderfully like conveyed, but we'll get to it. It's in all of that typical start, Phil. These movies, like I think you and I talked of, where kung fu comedies can either just make you sort of turn away because you can't stand a number one that feels the same. It can start serious, and then next scene you see the hero skipping down the street and set to quirky music, and you know, no, not again. I'm not having this again. But this does start that way that we're familiar with the darkness,
yeah,
with the pending doom and all of that. So, and hundreds of films have done it, and even slightly before, certainly after. But I think it comes down to this, Phil. When you're familiar with the kung fu genre very much, you know, even more than me, it comes down to, when you look back to it, who did it well?
Yeah.
And when you see Fearless Hyena, would you, and seeing it as it's dark, but it's also comedy later, would you argue that it's one of the ones that does the whole kung fu comedy well?
Yes. And I say that because it skips along quite nicely. don't get me wrong, this isn't the pinnacle of Jackie Chan in, you know, old school Kung Fu. You know, he perfected it later on with, you know, Young Master Dragon Lord and stuff. This is the start of something, and you can see that. And it's not a perfect movie by all means and stuff, but it's short enough in, like, you know, to scale up along quite nicely and hit all the beats, introduce the villain, the darkness, the villain coming in and have that character, then skip into those comedic scenes. And you know, it's a revenge movie and stuff. It hits all the beats that it should do. Some he misses slightly and some he gets great. And obviously the finale, you know, hits spot on and stuff, but it's that learning curve. And, you know, obviously his directorial debut, I think he was. His...
Yeah, sometimes it's quoted as, unofficially even, that out of all people, normally actor Kenneth Tsang co-directed this with Jackie, but on the print it's only Jackie, so I mean, an assistant directing thing maybe, but
yeah,
you can still say it's his debut, in my opinion.
Yeah, it is his debut, and for that, he must be, you know, applauded. Like I say, it's not the finished article. As one of those genre movies, I think it hits the spot, absolutely.
And I mean, I kind of agree, because I don't automatically tune out at all times. I keep bringing up that damn example with a Lung Ayan movie I watched. I think it was Thundering Mantis, and I love Lung Ayan. I don't like him in comedies, because especially when he looks like the vicious Lung Ayan, and see him skipping about and being a bumbling fool, it's not what I kind of like, you know.
Yeah,
that's,
you know, yeah.
It's not the character image that I prefer when it comes to Beardy, you know. But this doesn't give me that bad vibe, but it gives me a familiar vibe. And you know, the opening darkness and the you know, the intro of Yan Xiquan, who looks awesome in this movie. Again, a white-haired villain, long-haired villain, but looks so threatening. And, you know, I love that he doesn't have his hair in a ponytail. Rather, it's all, you know, it's free-flowing, and it makes him look so much more cooler, in my opinion. Like
exactly. We could have a cool villain. Yeah, absolutely.
He really does the trick for me. I keep thinking of, you know, back to Wang Zhang-li, in one of the Jackie movies, Drunken Master, but he, you know, he's played a white-haired villain, and often he looked very regal with his hair and very well braided and all of that. But here it's like Yan Xiquan is ready to go at a moment's notice, and it's going to be let loose anyway at some point, because when you fight, it's going to be like that, I suppose. But I don't know, it's not a subtle choice, but I like that choice. And then you cut to, you know, from serious to, for the sake of argument, some bumbling tomfoolery. And there's a jolly tune as Jackie's training with James Chen. And it's a feeling I've learned to hate, but not necessarily when Jackie is doing it. In his initial comedy movies, you know, Snake and Eagle Shadow and Drunken Master. Because his physicality feel and his comedic timing when engaging in this comedy and comedy kung fu, that timing is already sharp, and that brings belief to a kung fu comedy production even so many years on. And I have to say, he was always better at playing this young, mischievous character compared to a lot of actors who clearly wanted to be as good. But I can't name five or even three of them that were also as good as Jackie at this comedic style and character. You know what I mean? Like, often you just saw people being essentially pushed into the movie, like, you're Jackie Chan, act now, shoot it, like, action. And it never felt as good as when Jackie was doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's what he's found his way, isn't he? You're comfortable with Jackie Chan doing that, because that's what he's done, that's what he's known for. You know, he's perfected it. You know, you come along to Fearless Hyena, let's say, for argument's sake, directional debut and stuff, and he's already got 40 films under his belt, you know, various different statures in the industry, so he knows it, and he's got that comic timing, so he does it so well. You expect him, I think you know, hit the nail on the head with, you're familiar with Jackie Chan doing that. You're not familiar with Beardy doing that. It just doesn't seem right, you know what I mean? But you're familiar with Jackie doing that, whereas when you flip it the other way around and see Jackie, you know, in later years, and then he did something like Crime Store, which kind of like split people. It's like, well, I don't expect Jackie to be like, because he's kung fu comedy. Why is he playing it straight? I don't expect him. I'm not familiar with that as him doing that. So when people switch and do this other side or this different character to what people are used to, you're either familiar with that or you're not. You've got him in a certain genre, and it's difficult to pull him out of that. I mean, Jackie Chan nails it from a comical timing point of view, because that's what he does.
I think so. For initially, yeah, there are some shaky sequences, though, that I gotta single out, because not all comedy here hits. You know, the bullseye. He seems to, first of all, experiment a little as director with stylistic traits we've never seen since, as far as I remember, when he takes care of these three goons, and they're all different in size, and one of them is very big. And he throws him over, like, judo style or whatever. I don't know if it's judo, but he does throw him over his shoulder. And the camera bounces as the guy hits the ground. And he also puts a very wide-angle lens, sort of fisheye style, and shoots action that way for a few brief moments. And it's one of those things I think a young director here is trying to sort of, why don't we try this? Like, he's so big, like, we're doing a cartoon and we're comedic anyway, so why not let the ground shake? And you never seen Jackie do that, because I think he found out that, nah, probably not for me.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. And that's what I mean. This isn't the finished article as a director. This is him trying things out, and you're absolutely right in that scene and stuff. He's trying things out and you go, nah, that doesn't work. And obviously, you never saw it. He's never done that again. He's going, nah, that doesn't work either. But, you know, that he could try those, you know, and fair play to him for trying those, I suppose, you know, at the time he didn't. But you've got to try these things out. You put the wide angle, you put the, you know, the ground shaking, you put, you know, those different things. They didn't quite work. And those are the things you learn from, and you get better films as you go forward. But yes, like I say, you didn't always hit everything in the movie, and it's not a perfect movie by any means. And that certainly was a sequence that didn't work as well.
The whole when he starts to dress up later in the movie with the moustache and gets into the drag, that's where things start to drag. I'll get to it, though. But I just wanted to say that ground shake reminded me of the Korean movie Nowhere to Hide, where it was sort of just designed as this wild visual time, and one fight scene where you essentially see the shadows of the participants fighting, and at one point the whole letterbox frame also like boom starts to shake. but it was designed like that. Nowhere to Hide, that late 90s Korean movie. First Korean movie I ever watched. It's a fond memory. It's the one that ends with the fight in the rain and all of that.
Yes,
good fun. Where they also use the Bee Gees song quite effectively. Holiday. So there it is.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. So he doesn't. We'll get to it. The kind of key point that we're both making here is that he proves himself, but maybe not fully comedically, but certainly action wise by the end. But I want to single out one of my favorite aspects, you know, aside from the action ending, is the fact that I think Jackie Chan and James Chan make a great team on screen.
Yeah.
I can't remember James Chan being used as well as he is here, as especially action-wise. You know, in the Bruce Lee movies, it was a different era, an earlier era. So, but James Chan never broke through as an action performer for me. And he's been in a few of these Jackie movies from this time, but I don't remember specifics from them now, like Spiritual Kung Fu or whatever. But I love the exchanges they have as James Chan as the stern grandfather, who looks great, I think, as a granddad. Like, he is a young guy, but I think that standard makeup actually works, because Chen, I feel, it feels inspired in the role, kicking the crap out of his, you know, his student a little bit. You know, they use poles against each other at one point, and it goes as far as Jackie hiding under the house because he's so afraid.
Yeah, short one, long one. I love that scene, because it's just like, yeah, you have the short, just the move with the short one. He goes, you have the short one, then it's a move with the long stick. And he's saying, no, I want that one. Yeah, it works so well. The makeup's great on James Chen, I've just got to say, makes him look old. It does look, and it is great to see. He really, there was some acting chops there, and you don't expect him to be that kind of in that role. You wouldn't expect to go in, and I don't know how it came about that all of a sudden they went, actually, James Chen would be perfect for that role.
Yeah, you sort of get that feeling that it just, that boom, that was a bullseye casting, and he also keeps up with the action as well. I couldn't spot any doubling as such. And their exchanges are just gold as characters and action. I like when I get that feeling of, oh, my performers are on here. Mm-hmm. Like, the rhythm is on and the performers are on. And then you get a little bit of Dean Sheck in the movies in trouble. Okay, fair play. It's not. It's the style of the content of the sequences that follows, especially in the Kung Fu school and the dress up and all of that. That's where the movie gets in trouble for a good 15-20 minutes. So it's not Dean Sheck for 20 minutes, like doing that.
The other tidbit from that is Fearless Aina 2 that they did. Jackie Chan walked out of, obviously, and it was just cobbled together with footage. There's another scene with Dean Sheck in Fearless Aina 2, and he turns up as a restaurant owner. And I think, or I believe, that that scene was probably cut from the first Fearless Aina and put into the second one. Because he turns up again. I don't know whether there was an ongoing theme or would have been an ongoing theme where he turns up as like multiple different versions of himself or his brothers kind of thing.
Sounds stupid.
It's the same character. Yeah. Oh, really stupid.
The thing with Fearless Aina 2 is that it is indeed cobbled together. And it the sequences that are with Jackie, some are with doubles, obviously. But the sequences that are with Jackie will be in the context of Fearless Aina 2. They rightly feel like cutscenes because this is not good, man. This is not good stuff. Like, this is not gold. It's pure Lo Wei producer exploitation of his star because it was released like 4 years later, man.
Yeah, stay away, kids. Don't do it. Don't. You're all going to run out and watch it now, aren't you, Fearless?
You know, I'd recommend watching it because it's always fascinating to see how film producers work in terms of like the hot property. We got footage, dude. Like, they did it with Game of Death, of course. That's pure exploitation and it's crap as well.
I ran out and got it as soon as I found out. You know, I ran out. I wanted to see it because it had Jackie Chan in, full stop. That was, you know, I'll watch anything with Jackie Chan in. And, you know, as a kid, I ran out. Well, I want to see that. So, therefore, I got it as the curiosity. I knew, you know, we walked out in the movie. So, it was just, but it's interesting to watch from that point of view.
It is, indeed. Then the whole nonsense with Jackie Chan, like, becoming this, I was so confused, this master of this Kung Fu school, and he takes on the various fighters, both, he dresses up both with silly facial hair and a silly hat, and therefore making a silly face as well, and then he dresses up in drag versus a couple of fighters, two or three. Some of the action parts, very intricate and fun, but... And at one point, they bring in the Pink Panther film, you know? Du-dum, du-dum.
Du-dum.
Du-dum. Du-dum. But I gotta say, this is where the movie... I've seen it before, so I sort of knew this was coming. But this is where the movie didn't show a director and performer being pitch perfect with Kung Fu comedy at all. Now it looks like one of those endless ones that didn't star Jackie Chan. And, you know, it's a short movie. It's over in a good 10, 15 or 20 or maybe 10, 15 minutes. But it's the weak source of the film. It really is. Because I didn't find it funny or, like, in interesting action-wise.
I liked it when he dressed up as a woman. Why did I just say that? I can't believe I just said that.
Something wrong with that.
No, it was a flash. But then it was a flash forward to, like, City Hunter. It was like, just change the skirt. It looked exactly the same.
It's good fun in City Hunter.
Yeah, exactly the same. And it was quite comedic. But don't get me wrong, there's two decent 5-minute kind of like fights within that that are quite intricate and they're quite cleverly done from a choreography point of view, from a martial arts point of view. Yeah, we get silly with the character and I'd probably dismiss that. And usually I'm not like that because I'd go, I just poo-poo it, I hate it, I'd probably skip the scene. Yeah, anybody else would skip it because it's Jackie Chan and that's what I'm familiar with what he does. But I'll watch it for other reasons, like I say, the fight choreography within those scenes and how he plays those out. But you're right, it slows the movie down. It isn't the best part of the movie at all.
You know, you're absolutely spot on that some of the choreography within all of this feature, you know, with Jackie just avoiding being hit, all of this is like featuring awe-inspiring number of movements per shot and all of that. So there's flashes of brilliance here. But for me, it is a lamer sidetrack, although he sort of injects the fact that this is him trying to make money for his grandfather, and therefore it is part of the plot, but it's still a lamer sidetrack for me personally. And but again, it's we're out of it, you know, fairly quickly, and you get the whole generic Kung Fu template storyline kicked into motion with the reappearance of Yen Shi Kwan and his men in capes. I love that they all wear long capes. Love it. It's just so, I don't know, it's just so, I don't know if it doesn't seem like that kind of world necessarily, but they're bad guys. We wear long capes.
Exactly. It defines them, doesn't it? They're bad guys. We're going to wear capes. Excellent. All right. Why not?
And they're not even like open capes, Dracula style. Like they, yeah. they're closed. So they're walking around in like, we're protected from the rain now. So I just love that. It's one of those quirks that, not even quirks, but things that tickle me. But I don't look down on the movie because of this design choice or anything. It's just, yep, there it is.
That's the wardrobe. No, I hated the wardrobe. Therefore, I hate the movie.
Like if you're gonna pick on wardrobe in kung fu movies, like it's not really the movie to deconstruct exactly, production design, costume design. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. I think one should give much sense and sensibility if one wants to critique the costumes on display.
Wasn't that the one that Ang Lee directed? He directed one of those with Emma Thompson and Hugh Grant. So there's like a little connection to our shows here.
Yeah, but, I like the way you did that. I was thinking of. The zombie one.
Yeah, of course you will.
Yeah.
Because you're you.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. Anywho, moving swiftly on.
But yes, the dark turns that obviously happens because the story warrants it. They are more interesting, especially after this, for me, lamer comedic sequence. But it's all about revenge, and we're familiar with that. It's rarely like super dramatic and tear-jerking. But when you convey power through the bad guy, which we get through Yen Shi Kwan, who's fantastic action performer, very powerful. He's got a very distinct look, and his presence is felt. Like, you know, if you remember the villain from a kung fu movie in a fond way, other than I remember he was the villain in the kung fu movie, then there's something there. There's effort there. There's inspiration there to make this villain stand out, and I think it's a good little showcase for Yen Shi Kwan. I really, really do, and that look, he was sort of just made for that look. It feels to me like, training sequence. Love or hate them when they enter a kung fu movie field.
I love them. They're the staple. You've got to have the training montage. I mean, it's great. You know, everybody does it. Hollywood does it. There are better ones, but you know, it serves a purpose, and I enjoyed it. And it's clever. I think the bowl sequence is quite clever as well, what he's done there. And he's done something different. But yeah, I enjoyed it. You really want, great, it's a training. Quick, let's get on to the revenge bit every time I say a training bit. But, you know, it motivates you towards that.
You are astounded by two things here. The physicality of Jackie. I can't even describe what it is he's doing, but let me try, and you can then take over if you will. At one point, he's hung upside down, and he's facing a wooden board, which he needs to push himself away from, and then do like a reverse crunch before he hits the board, and he obviously does when he's down, when he's in the crunch or whatever, and he does that over and over. It's mind-boggling how his physicality allows for this, what looks like fairly punishing training for, you know, a real workout. I mean, have you ever been able to do that? You practice martial arts.
Oh, yeah, back in the day, I was doing that all the time down the gym. No, not a chance in a million years. I mean, that's, you know, his physical prowess at the time. He's very, very lean in the movie anyway and stuff, but he's just ripped to... It's just phenomenal, actually. Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic sequence, and that's what made the cut of the film. Imagine how many times he must have done that to get those shots.
Yeah, he does it a lot in the movie, and just imagine how long that camera ran for, you know. And it's marvelous. But then within all of this, we get the introduction of some, not for the kung fu comedy genre sort of standard fighting technique or anything. We get an idea that I've never seen before, and I'm not sure we need to see it again because it's so perfect here. He starts the grandmaster that he trains with. It starts a little bit like he hints that he needs to, you know, yelp and then brace himself to deflect pain.
Yeah.
And you look at that. Huh. I think this is new. You know, go on. This is totally odd, but odd is only the beginning of it, as the finale will show. But you know, it's, was this, you know, appealing to you, the type of train that Jackie goes through, and what the ultimate technique is? It's not even Snake, it's not even Cat, it's not even Drunken, it's, you know, what it is, listeners, is that he's learning emotional Kung Fu, essentially.
It's clever. I mean, yeah, it's just utter brilliance, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, use your emotions against your opponent, and then he comes up with the Kung Fu style, these four different emotions, I think it is. It's just so clever. Something that's not, you'd never seen before. And that's where this elevates the movie to something else, because it was just so inspiring to do this. And it works, because when you think about it, it shouldn't, because a couple of them,
it's
sound
so
really
stupid, so it shouldn't
it's so
work.
Stupid, but Jackie pulls it off on all of them somehow. And, you know, it's marvelous. It's a wonder to behold.
I mean, we get obviously the standard things within the training montage of him and his acrobatic prowess and all of that. And that's, you know, the ability and the speed, and it's jaw-dropping as he, you know, demos on the beach and all of that. But, you know, the ultimate technique is still in feel very new. And I can't believe how well this is conveyed. I mean, you know, fast forward to the end fight, I don't have many details on it, but my favorite image from it is Jackie, you know, when he starts you know, going forward, crying and fine, laughing and yeah, fighting at the same time, like a kid who's crying, essentially. I don't know how he had this in him, because he is so perfect at doing that, and it's such a
brilliant
what. And it's got fight choreography. Yeah. It's not him just being like me, but he's fighting too.
So you've got obviously joy, melancholy, happiness, and anger. That's what they put it down. I mean, yeah, joy. You can interpret that any way you want. But watch it, and you'll kind of see where he's going with that one. But and then he conveys those emotions in a Kung Fu style. So, you know, joy. And your anger, which he uses less, and melancholy, which is when he's just literally walking up to him and then flipping around him and falling on him and sobbing and stuff. And after, you will be sobbing in a bit, I'm going to kill you. And he's like, I'm running up to him. And it shouldn't work. And yet it does. It works. It's just sheer brilliance. I mean, that's the wonder of it, that it shouldn't work. And yet it does. It's so brilliant. And then by the time he gets that anger and you've gone through these range of emotions and Kung Fu styles that fit in with those emotions and stuff, you're like, yes, just get in. And, you know, anger is you can relate to more and the others are, you know, kind of offbeat to a certain extent. But it's just so well done. And it's brilliant. Yeah,
I love it. It's a unique end fight, all right, and it doesn't run too long either, which is a good sign of a filmmaker thinking. Young Master, he had maybe too much fun playing with Wang In Sik for the ending, because then all of a sudden that finale is like 20 minutes.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, this is like 5 minutes with the cloaked henchman, which is very good in itself, and then 10 minutes with the finale, which is perfect, and it works out quite well. And I suppose he could have elongated that slightly longer and stuff, but the, you know, the finishing blow, we'll leave that for you to watch, is, you know, is well deserved.
He's also, before he gets to Yan Shiquan, there are a couple of moments that are just inspiring as well, when he is you know, avoiding and fighting the henchmen, and the way Jackie goes from high to low and you know, and bounces around like a bouncing ball trying to avoid them is he's still mind-blowing, obviously, because this physical ability is from this time, so unique for this time, obviously, is never getting old to watch. Yeah, and then as he turns all limp when he's sad and starts to drop on Yan Shiquan, so it's wonderful. Like, and it is a shame it's not really it's not for my money's worth. Again, I'm not following the discussion everywhere, but it seems like Fearless Hyena is sort of, it's not lost, it's not a lost movie, but it's either that people tend to love Snake and Eagle, Shadow, Drunken Master, Young Master, Dragon Lord so much more, or they don't like Fearless Hyena. I don't know, but it seems like it's it's not in the discussion as much when talking of his Kung Fu comedy highlights.
You're right. It's almost lost within the mass. I mean, Drunken Master's there, and you get Snake and Eagle Shadows there, and you get Dragon Lord and your Young Master. And Phyllis Anna doesn't really get a mention in those the same breadth as those films. And yet, Phyllis Hyena, for everything, it's good and bad points. For that last 15 minutes of the movie, should be, you know, said in the same breath. And I won't say Drunken Master, but certainly The Young Master, Dragon Lord, Snake and Eagle. It should be in the category of films when people mention, you know, old school Jackie Chan. And I suppose they are. And, you know, this is what the podcast is about, is to get people to feedback and say, well, you know, is Phyllis Hyena mentioned in those circles? Is it now a little bit of a lost film in the Jackie Chan's filmography or what? So, you know, tell
because
us.
Because maybe I'm wrong. I just don't get a feeling that it's brought up as much.
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully that does this and it brings people, and if they've not seen it, you know, and you enjoy Jackie Chan kung fu movies, then, you know, please seek it out, because it's a hell of a movie for the last 15 minutes. And
Well, we'll conclude this with some availability then, and it is available on Blu-ray in Hong Kong. This is the Fortune Star remaster, and knowing them, and also watching screen caps for myself, this looks to be a standard definition version upscaled to high definition, and the Blu-ray only has remix options for this mono movie, which might make it sound quite bad with new fighting effects and all of that. So don't overpay, at least, and be aware that it might sound quite bad. The 2-pack on DVD that featured the part 2 as well, also based on the 14-star remaster, had a 2.0 mono option listed, and hopefully that was original mono and not downmixed from the remixes. But it is listed as out of stock currently, that 2-pack DVD, but it's available on eBay. I checked, and the prices are very reasonable, so it's not this like £1,000 rare title or anything. Which, believe me, people will jack prices if they get a sense of this is rare. So yeah, if you want to find a DVD, then you can get it. Columbia TriStar in the US put out a DVD of both 1 and 2 quite a number of years ago, and they can still be bought for a reasonable price. They were widescreen, at least the first anyway, original mono, but the subtitles were based on the English dub and not a translation of the Chinese dialogue, so be aware of that if that's something you care about. And finally, UK's Hong Kong Legends also did a late DVD, part of their sort of fairly special featureless super bit high bit range, where it was only the movie with the highest bit rate possible, I suppose, but this was also featuring remix options only, so I'm not sure how that sounded, but I do remember they put out one and a couple of these old Jackie Chan movies in between, you know, in and around and in between Snake and Eagle Shadow and Drunken Master. They did, like, you know, Magnificent Bodyguards and stuff like that. So did you, as a matter of fact, get that Hong Kong Legends DVD at any point?
Yes, I did. Actually, and to be fair, going back to our point of do people want it was one of the ones that was difficult to get hold of on Hong Kong Legends, which shows you how popular it probably is, because at one point it was up there with the Mr. Vampire of the Hong Kong Legend original DVD, difficult to get hold of, Dreadnought kind of territory. So yeah, I've got that. That's in my collection.
Yeah, they did. It came at the tail end of the Hong Kong Legends range, the life of it. So they weren't producing any special editions at that point. But okay, we are done. Then we are taking a musical break, because now that we are concluding the Infernal Affairs coverage, why not feature some of the wonderful music yet again? The very the score is, you know, obviously composed, but it apparently features a Hungarian choir. You know, the whole choir thing in the movie? That's sung by a Hungarian troupe, apparently. So the composer went abroad, presumably, to get some of the voices that he or she deemed suitable for the movie. And it is indeed very beautiful. So let's have a listen to that for a little bit. And we'll be back to conclude the crime saga, Infernal Affairs, by reviewing the third one. So sit tight, and we'll be back.
Oh,
And welcome back, and we conclude this episode with Infernal Affairs 3, our review of it and our coverage of the trilogy. Now comes to an end. So thank you for following our, for once we did a serious coverage of something, and because it only made sense to go through it all. And we're at the third one, and it's time to say goodbye to these characters. But the plot from the Love HK film review of the film. First of all, a little bit lengthy, but I think you'll get it, and it's fairly easy to follow, as I always say. So Infernal Affairs 3 takes place in essentially... By the way, before I do that, but by now, if you're listening to this and haven't seen Infernal Affairs 1 in particular, like we are going to spoil that, because in the plot... And at the start of the movie, you'll know some certain characters have died in the first one. So yeah, obviously, we're not going to spoil the third one and what happens at the end of that. But obviously, things that happen in one that are crucial will be spoiled even in this plot synopsis. So be aware and go watch the first one at least, and then come back to us. Anyway, Infernal Affairs 3 takes place in essentially two distinct time periods. The months leading up to the death of Yan, Tony Leung Chiu Wai, and nearly a year after his death. Here in the present time, Ming, played by Andy Lau, has just been cleared of any charges in Yan's death, a process that was more red tape than actual suspicion of guilt. Still, he hasn't been sitting on his hands. Apparently, when Ming offed Billy, played by Gordon Lam, in the elevator at the end of the first movie, Billy offered up some interesting news. Some cassette tapes were delivered to Ming's boss, which supposedly contained conversations between bastard crime lord Sam, played by Eric Tsang, and his moles. The tapes were intercepted by one of the moles, but now months later the tapes have resurfaced into possession of Security Inspector Jung, played by Leon Lai, a new addition to the trilogy. There were 5 moles, 4 of them are now dead or missing. Ming knows he's the last one, but how to make sure no one else finds out? The path to Ming's goal, total separation from his secret triad life. He wants to be a good guy, as one of the key lines are in the movie. The path to that seems a rather obvious one. Finger someone else as the mole, a task which seems a lot easier since Jung apparently had secret ties to Sam, Leon Lai's character Jung. Even more, Jung has some sort of relationship with Shen, played by mainland actor, I think he's a mainland actor, Chen Daoming, who was in Hero. And he's a mainland crime lord who had a deal going with Sam over a year later, and flashback, the movie's flashback structure, shows that that deal is at the center of Tony Leung's Yan's tale, which unfolds during a time when he was still under Sam's wing. Yan is still trying to feed intel to Inspector Wong, played by Anthony Wong, so they're all back, but things are murkier than he would like. Sam is paranoid and unpredictable, and Yan frequently finds himself caught in Sam's tricky mind games. I even shortened the plot a little bit, but that's the gist of what went on and what is going on. So, yeah, let me take the reins this time. In terms of my short opinion, the Andy Lau movie is great. The Eric Tsang, Tony Leung, Anthony Wong, and the rest movie struggles a little bit. It's good, but it struggles. We could have imagined what the continuous hell would have been like had we only had 2 movies, right? That would have been up to our imagination, but I'm happy to see how it plays out in the wake of key characters dying and seeing how Andy Lau's character progresses or not. And the switch back and forth in time, it makes it a little bit hard to follow, but not too much. But the ultimate like satisfaction for me, where I think this is partly very riveting, is that I love following Andy Lau's character's psychological journey reach its conclusion. And Andy Lau puts in a hell of a performance here in star presence and dedicated dramatically to this character. So it all comes home. I think he brings it home, even though it's shaky partly. So that's my short opinion. What do you want to say about Infernal Affairs 3 in short?
Yeah, Infernal Affairs 3 tagline, fill in the blanks. That's my interpretation of the movie. It's fill in the blanks for the other two movies. And you're right, this is the Andy Lau show. This is what you watch going through the others, you know, as a film. It works, and it's a good film, and it's never going to match the first two. It was never going to be that way, but as a fill in the blanks kind of movie, clever in what they've done or tried to do, and it is a bit tricky to follow at times, and the back and forth, but I think they did a good job. It's just never going to hit the highs of the first two.
I have a question coming up for you, but I wanted to say first, like, so much right things, so many right things have been established through two movies, through its stars, its actors, the material, the sound filmmaking from Alan Mack and Andrew Lau. It all came together to generate commercialism, but also nuanced filmmaking. And this timeline in the movie, you know, starting from the 90s leading up to 2002-03 or whatever, it's engaging for me when it comes to Andy Lau's Ming, who said this shape-shifting mole, let's say. So I'm glad to see that concluded, but there could have been I just wish there would have been like a 90-minute movie, sans Eric Tsang and all of those people, just Andy Lau and obviously the cast members in the present that would apply. I would have liked to see that, but so I welcome a third. I like to see this character journey psychologically reach its very riveting conclusion. So, but do you welcome a third one? Like, was that riveting for you to see the conclusion of Andy Lau's character, or would you like to had that left in the open in terms of what happened after the elevator, you know, after he exits the elevator and one shows his cop and that would be the end of it? Like, what would you prefer when all is said and done?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? Because I think watching it the first time, I think, why did you do the third movie? I would have liked it left open-ended, but watching it a second time again, I appreciate it more, especially with the journey of Andy Lau. So if you just take that as a film itself, and I think it works really well, and understanding that journey and it comes to the end and that conclusion, I think it deserved to be a movie. They've padded it out somewhat and tried to be, I don't know if tried to be too clever. It's clever in a movie and what they've tried to do. Does it work? Not entirely. But I'm glad they did it at the end. Watching it again, I think, yeah, I'm glad it concludes the trilogy of movies, and it, you know, it does work overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree, and I love that it starts after we get flashback imagery and both just on the soundtrack on the dark screen of the elevator shootout, and I love that it starts in the present day on an elevator, and you see Andy Lau exit from it because it's key imagery, and he seems to be a little bit lost in his thoughts. You know, it's either that he's cold to all of these events, that he doesn't face him, or that he's reminded of harrowing events. Because we already know, starting from Infernal Affairs 2, that this character has done some very heinous thing. I mean, he's the one that ordered the killing of Eric Tsang's wife, you know, when she gets hit by the car in the airport, just because he was the love wasn't returned to him, you know. So he's even in his young years, been this very shaky character. And, you know, as he got his promotions in the police department up to internal affairs, it's you're clear, you have seen much evidence of the character's sanity being there's cracks in that, if you will. So, and you should also watch Andy Lau underplay a lot of this stuff. You know, there is a scene early on where he's sitting in administration while he's waiting for the board to reach a conclusion whether or not he was responsible for the elevator deaths and all of that. So he's sitting on the phone he's talking to Mary, his wife, the Sammy Chen character, and he confirms that he's going to sign the divorce documents, but he's all quiet, and essentially he doesn't want to say yes. And probably she's prompting him on the other line, like, what do you say? Yes or no? Yes or no? Sign it. And he's looking down, so he's not watching the camera as he does this. And then he has an outburst and just clears his desk, and then cut to the fact that that was just a mental outburst. And you should, listeners, pay attention to two things here. One, Andy Lau underplaying. And I love when Hong Kong cinema realizes that underplaying is actually a good thing. You don't need to be outspoken about everything and melodramatic. But pay attention to details such as mental events versus real events in the eyes of Andy Lau's character. Because there's some shaky things going on there. So early on, Andy Lau shows that he has not grown tired of this at all. He's ready to conclude this character journey, which is not going to end up well. We can just say that. Like, it's always been like the continuous hell theme has always been there. This doesn't mean that it all worked out and all swell by the end of the third one. Not really. Any thoughts on Andy Lau, the actor, now that you've seen him in three, well, you've seen him in more movies, but now these three performances, is it still impressive to you?
Yeah, Angelo is, you know, the right kind of vehicle. He's always impressive. And like you said, when he underplays it, he's one of those actors that can do that. And you're riveted to him, hence why you want to see a movie full of Andy Lows, I guess. Could be one way to look at it. And that's why you want to see that journey. And you feel for him in some respects. And and that's the way he portrays it. Or although he's done these, you know, heinous things throughout the movies and stuff, he still portrays that part of him that still doesn't. You know, he wants to be the good guy and all this, and he still portrays that, and he brings that across. And that's clever. That's acting cleverly to portray different mixtures of emotions and come across in different aspects of the character. And someone of Andy Lau's stature can bring that across in his performance. And that's what's so great to watch someone like that.
Yeah, he really responds to this quite complex character journey of, you know, this mole who maybe in his own mind thinks that he can turn the corner. You know, he's even the one that killed Sam, obviously, in the first one. So, and he never really knows his motivations. He seems like a loose cannon, too. But it has always been interesting to me. And Andy Lau his outbursts are deserved, especially at the end of this movie, which we won't spoil. But they are always deserved. I think Andrew Lau and Alan Mack saved those four well-timed moments of an outburst. Short note on the addition of Leon Lai, not a tested actor as such. He can be awful, he can be excellent, depending on the material, really. He's never been that super sharp and skilled throughout all his filmography, but I like his role here as the character of Jung. Seems a very cold, like a cold, calculated, corrupt police officer. We think that anyway, judging by the first scene where he busts into this triad run club and have his people beat people up, and he doesn't face him like he's this is all business as usual. And I feel he even says, like, I feel like hitting someone tonight, I feel like beating people up tonight, or having people beat up. It's actually not his intro scene. We're watching the director's cut of the movie that's on the DVD, hopefully the Blu-ray as well. So this intro scene is actually added to the director's cut. His actual intro scene is where he's at gunpoint in one of the departments. One of his former employees eventually shoots himself in front of him, and we find out eventually what all that is about. Furthermore, we'll get to the Jan story and all of that, but there are contrivances and also some further weakness in terms of how the women are portrayed in this movie and their drama. But there are some contrivances here that even I noticed, because and I'm stupid. I'm so damn stupid. I couldn't spot a continuity error if it whacked me over the face. You know, not at all. There's a scene where Andy Lau goes into that big evidence room that we see in at least Infernal Affairs 2. It's the room where Anthony Wong and Eric Tsang have their opening dialogue in the second movie. And there's also some interrogation going on in that room. And now this room is filled with tons of boxes. It's an evidence room. And for some reason, Andy Lau just finds what he needs to find this room.
Yeah, as you do. Needle in the head, like, I found it. That's great.
It's one of the contrivances. There's another one, the password one later in the movie. Come on, that is not well conveyed. That is, I can buy coincidences most of the time. That was just, come on. But so it feels a little shakier in confidence because they're trying to squeeze out a continuation partly here.
Well, there you go. I mean, look, you've just hit upon an idea for Infernal Affairs 4, where they just entirely shoot it within the evidence room, where in actual fact, it doesn't actually pinpoint the file in 1 minute. It's actually 1 hour and 40 minutes.
Where is it? God damn it, where is it? I got to get coffee now. That would have been fun. Like they took a right turn with this.
Andy Lau in a room with loads of boxes of files, sifting through them.
I can't find it! Do you know where it is?
You could put dream-like flashbacks to the other movies within that, but him constantly going back to him sitting in that evidence room. Just an idea.
Do you get that feeling as well, or not? If it's partly it feels like an unnatural continuation based on commercialism. Like, we got to get everyone in there again. Like, he finds the photo. Like, it's like there's a million documents in there. He totally finds it, I guess.
It made a good point. You know, we reviewed the director's cut, and going back before when I watched it, I didn't watch the director's cut, so it was good to watch the director's cut, and it does add more to this movie. Okay, there's a couple of scenes. It doesn't, but you know, I like that opening scene in the nightclub. That adds something to it. I love that very much. So, and there are scenes there that really help this movie along. Really make somebody coming into it understand the movie better. I feel so. I'd recommend the director's cut because there is more to it. But you're right; they've shoehorned everything in, and if they'd stripped that away and just had it about Andy Lau and stuff, I think it would have been a better movie. But they tried to do something bigger, epic, you know, and they threw everybody at it. Didn't necessarily work, but I appreciate that and admire their ambition to try and do something.
Yeah, for sure. And also playing around with the editing too, because the jump in the timeline sometimes happen by when a door opens, you know, and they put captions on screen to kind of know, let us know in a fairly subtle way where we're at and all of that. But, you know, when it does cut to, you know, the gang of Eric Tsang, Tony Leung, we got Chapman Toe is back, obviously, and that story of the pending arms deal with the mainland. And, I mean, how does it feel to you? Does it add to the Infernal Affairs trilogy, or is it just sort of cool to see them back?
No, it's just cool to see them back, isn't it? Like I say, you just want to see the journey of Andy Lau, and everything else is just the side dish before the main course.
Yeah, because it doesn't feel like it's just some more stuff that happened to Jan, you know, Tony Leung's character. And no one's bad here, but it doesn't matter as much anymore.
No, exactly. And that's it. It doesn't matter as much. All that doesn't matter. You know everything that kind of went on. What you want to know is what's going on with Andy Lau's character and that journey that he's taken, and get to that. So you kind of switch off to the other scenes to a certain extent because you just want to follow, you know, Andy Lau and see where that journey takes him.
I mean, they do have something to do, obviously, because with it all, because Leon Lai appears in the flashback. The character of Shen, the Shen Daoming character, will have a crucial part. So they feed into it, but still, there is some repetition here going on. Like, for instance, Eric Tsang's Sam, who's now obviously lost all his warmth, as we know, after being quite warm and happy-go-lucky in the second movie, and not as much in the first, certainly not here. His mind tricks go a little bit on repeat because he does sort of the same things he does in the first movie. He has another dialogue with Tony Leung in the bar that seems like he's trying to find out if he's a mole or not. And there's a point at the end of the movie where he sort of traps Jan, we can say that without spoiling too many things. Just sort of out of, you can... Like he can fend for himself. Like, I don't care. Like it almost feels like he's gleeful about it. And some of those things, Eric Tsang is great at that. Some of those things I felt like, I think I've seen this before. This doesn't add to Sam's arc and our impact and our fear of him necessarily. It's another episode that does feature key characters that will help the movie conclude, yes. But I think you're right. Shoehorned in all the stars so to make sure that like the all three movies are filled with stars. I don't know. But I just would have loved that brave choice of just stripping it down and making it, you know, an Andy Lau, Leon Livy, of course, essentially.
And you're right. And this isn't us slagging off the movie because it's still
not
a great
all.
Movie. But it's a great movie. The other two were, you know, magnificent and stuff, and it was never going to hold up to that. So we're getting probably critical and over criticizing what they tried to make this movie into, because we think we could have been a better movie for what they were trying to achieve, but we appreciate their ambitions. So it's still a great movie. Just looking at it from a critical point of view, there's things that could have been, you know, taken away and, like I say, shoehorned in.
I've seen lazier commercialism. Have I ever seen lazier commercialism? A lot of this is like brave choices. Like, we're going to play with editing and we're going to play with the timeline going back and forth. And so they did something, you know, they took a chance here on a lot of things. And one angle that we reserved sort of our judgments from the first movie of Kelly Chien's role and her performance in terms of how it's all going to matter. And here we get a more fleshed out version of what went on during the 5 months of sessions with her as the psychologist and Jan as obviously the patient, because he's beaten up someone and therefore he's ordered to go into a psychological treatment. And they share a connection during those few months, and you see her mourning at her grave initially in the movie. And So yeah, here's the op to sort of flesh that out. And I gotta tell you, Phil, I didn't buy their connection.
No.
It doesn't need to be like I didn't buy their romantic connection, but it's not really about that. You know, he fantasizes about that at one point.
Yeah.
But it's more about a human connection. And in all shortness, for once, I did not buy that. And it's a shame because Kelly Chen really devotes herself to this role, going through some fairly well-executed emotions on screen. But as far as their connection, nah. Like, Tony Leung is a charming motherfucker. But, you know, he's a dreamboat. And anyone would be infatuated with him. But as for a human connection and a character connection, nah, I didn't buy it. I didn't feel it, Phil. I didn't feel it. I'm dead inside, I know, but I didn't feel it anyway.
I'm dead inside. No. You're right. There wasn't that spark. That might have added something
spark
to it.
Spark is a good word, yeah.
Yeah, spark. I don't know why. It just didn't. It didn't happen. That would have elevated, I think, those scenes to something special. But he didn't. She's a good actress in her own right. Tony Leung, we know he oozes that appeal. But he didn't. They didn't quite connect. Like I say, that spark wasn't there. It's a shame.
Her scenes with Andy Lau are better when you return to the fallout after all of this, and she returns to her office, and he wants to find out what she wrote in the file. So because she kept like file notes of the sessions and all of that. So all the investigative sequences that follow, where Andy Lau breaks into her office and a variety of surveillance that he conducts,
yeah,
all of that is pretty damn good. It's a stretch of non-verbal filmmaking, obviously looking at monitors and trying to find out passwords, yes. But again, we get a focus on Andy Lau trying to cover his tracks, but also slowly but surely, the directors reveal that he is not right in the head, probably. There is something off here. You know, at one point he receives like a phone call that's definitely plays out in his head. Like he hears... He's watching like the monitor, watching Leo Lai, and then he picks up a phone and you hear essentially conversations that would have been on one of the tapes. Like, I think you hear a Zhang on there. It's not even anyone calling him.
Yeah.
Well, we find out it is actually, but what he's hearing is something entirely different. And that is interesting to me. Like, it sounds like it's on the nose, like it's cuckoo, but no, I think it's so, it's fairly intelligent and through Andy Lau's mostly underplayed descent here. It's really like, it's not like, stop harassing me on the phone, I'm not going mad.
Yeah.
Like no, he's not doing that at all. So and finally, like I won't spoil anything, but I want to say that the dual shrink session, the psychology session, where you see both Tony Leung and Andy Lau, obviously not both there, but for illustrative purposes they feature them. Andy Lau's character finally lets things seep through the cracks. He says something to her while he's almost hypnotized, because it's a technique that she uses. And what he says, like the reveal he says, is really mind-blowing to me, because now it is that continuous hell, and it's all cracking up more than cracks now. Now there's big holes in that surface, and it's gonna steamroll into the ending and all of that, which we won't spoil. But
no, it's clever the way that scene, because you actually sit there and watch and go, I can't believe you just said that.
Because it's been festering in his head all of this. I want to be a good guy. I'm a cop. I want to be a good guy. I'm a cop. And after a while, that's just the system backfires. Let's just say that. Totally.
Yeah.
I think you know, the Andy Leon movie, essentially tons of goodwill building towards a fairly complex but riveting conclusion, and there's some really immense imagery towards the end, non-spoiler, and it makes us realize just how much, like, what kind of a gleeful plan Sam got his moles into, you know, or maybe he couldn't perceive how deep they were going to fall into this role, you know, how and maybe it's, you know, they wouldn't be able to return anyway. That was never the point for him. Or his point was all about getting intel, and these are disposable guys. But you realize how deep he falls, And he saw us being pulled in a lawless and vice versa type of direction. You see that in the first movie, but there's I think it's very affecting what happens towards the end, and very shocking that what we know of all these cracks mentally, like, okay, that makes sense, but it's still shocking.
Yeah,
how far gone it shows that he is towards the end.
Yeah, and that's what makes it, elevates this to a great movie with his all its shortcomings, because that build up towards the ending, and you kind of sit there in awe as it kind of happens, and you kind of see this journey to the end of the finale of the movie. It's just great, you know, it's just great to watch.
In his big reveal.
Yeah.
It takes place over a tape recorder. So you and I know what we're talking about. That reveal doesn't come with like a big music sting or anything. Like, Andrew Lau and Alan Mack are so damn clever. Together, mind you. You know, we've slagged off Andrew Lau, but I think as merch, they are very good filmmakers, both of them. And coupled with the Felix Chong, Alan Mack script. But there's no like music sting for, oh my god, yeah, a big reveal. No, not at all. They trust their audiences, dude.
Mm.
And yeah, that is a wonderful thing to see. And those images stick with me, Phil. They really do. That's why it's so worth it to go through some slightly shakier sequences, because you are genuinely just shocked how far gone things have gone.
And that's the sign of the great filmmakers, because over the trilogy, you've had those moments, literally, those you sit in awe moments. And it happens in the third one as well, so that's why it's still a great movie in that respect, because you admire what they've done, and they let the audience sink into the characters. And like I say, this is Andy Lau's movie from start to end. And,
I think he won an award in Taiwan for this one, because eventually they gave him one for he's been nominated, and sometimes he's... Award juries, I think, have always felt to me like a little bit hesitant to give him an award like that.
Yeah.
Like, and eventually they started doing that. Running Out of Time was his first Hong Kong Film Award, I believe, and he's won since for at least Running on Karma in either Taiwan and Hong Kong, and probably once more or twice more since then. So now he's legit, yo.
Yeah, and he won. It was Best Actor for the Golden Horse Awards.
Yeah, that would be Taiwan.
Yeah. Yeah, that was he won Best Actor,
and fully deserved. And you know, I asked you, like, how do you feel about a third movie? And you sort of, well, yeah, I mean, maybe without it, we would have lived, of course. But seeing the ending imagery, for me anyway, I just think it's so worth it.
Worth the journey.
And it was not a difficult journey, not at all. But it's some of the let me be as vague as possible. After one of the many big things happened towards the end, and as the people look on shocked, you know, at one, you know, there's been some gunshots fired, and then some people are sitting down and they're just looking in shock, essentially seeing, like, they realize how, like, all of a sudden everything makes sense. Like, there's been 10 years of this stuff, and it's the interface of the extras. Some of that stuff gets to me. I remember that, because to just look in shock, like, oh my god, it was this. It was about this. And they bring in the score, obviously, for a key point towards that end. And it's very good. The Andy Lau Show, and it was all worth it getting to this point. And they're very much easy rewatches for me as well.
Mm.
Like, I like to go on this journey for one and two, like, near perfect movies.
Yes. And I enjoy retreading those steps again and just coming back to them, watching those back to back again, and enjoying them and looking at them again. And yeah, like I say, and I've said it before, we're overcritical with the third one, because you are, and the first two are so great, but it's still a great movie, because that crescendo that it builds to is so worth that journey. The payoff is there for the trilogy. It definitely there. So it's that journey is complete.
And again, they don't beat us over the head with the Buddhist theme. They stick to at the beginning, because, you know, the opening credits, like when the elevator goes down, you see Buddhist statues in the elevator shaft. But and they do a piece of text as the screen fades to black. So they've never been they've been clever in that regard. Like, they've been very open about how this can be compared to Buddhism and the lowest level of hell and all of that, Avicii or something like that.
Yeah.
But as we said during the first and probably second review, that can add but it can also be taken away, and it's a damn fine gangster crime cops saga.
Yeah, yeah.
And isn't that great? That we can have, that we can add to it if we like, right? Like, it's not requisite that you need to be this smart to understand it, no? Not
at all. Exactly. Not at all. And it's clever. You've got multi-layers, which then again opens it up to even more people, and more people have discussions on the trilogy, and more people have their interpretations on the continuous hell and how that's interpreted and the whole Buddhist thing around that. And you can have a conversation, and it's a completely different layer on top, or you can strip that layer off and still enjoy the trilogy of movies for what they are, is good, you know, gangster film. So, yeah, it's very clever.
It kickstarted Hong Kong cinema, right? And they earned going through three movies, I think, and very much glad they did. These are iconic classics, and Hong Kong cinema have gone through different stages even since then. You know, nowadays it's very much mainland and Hong Kong influenced. But regardless of all of that, like, it's not a comparison to then versus now I'm talking about, but it was, it needed to be kicked in the butt a little bit. People needed to go to the movies again, and via these three movies, that was part of the start, especially the first one, which just blew up like you read about. And yeah, so that I think that's the end of my notes. And again, I might as well ask you this. We said we watched the director's cut. We won't say obviously what it contains. We will link to an illustration of what is added, but we can say it is most of the stuff, 90% of the added stuff, takes place towards the end to clarify matters. And I'm glad they did, because the Hong Kong theatrical version, there are some kind of knew what happened, but and they like there's a scene in an office, and some extra scenes with Leon Lai and Chen Dao Ming, and they do help, I think, to, and they don't add, so this becomes 2.5 hours or anything. It's about 10 minutes longer, so it's almost a 2-hour movie, and we're used to this being a 2-hour saga anyway with the second one and stuff. So what did you think? Did you appreciate the clarity that the director's cut gave you?
Absolutely. Watching the cut version, theatrical cut, I was very much director's cut makes, and okay, you've seen it once anyway, but director's cut makes things a lot easier to follow, and they're not wasted scenes. Like you say, 90% of them are not wasted within that. And so yeah, director's cut is definitely the recommended choice.
Yeah, it doesn't pad out the movie needlessly after it's done or anything, because it doesn't drag things out. I mean, we got an additional scene with cameos from prior cast members. They are listed at the top of the movie, so at one point you realize there's going to be more cameos from characters in this universe, obviously. But it works, man. It works. I'm really happy that all three exists, even though I can poke holes a little bit in the third one. Any other notes, my friend?
No, all good. Like I say, grab the trilogy and sit down and enjoy a marathon session one night.
Why not? I'd totally show this over like across 3 nights to someone. You know what I mean? Like, I think that would be a nice little thing. And as for availability, to repeat some info from before, because it's the same, really. There's no shortage of DVDs or Blu-rays out there, including in Hong Kong. It's been assembled on DVD and on Blu-ray in a trilogy box set. We've since gotten confirmation from David Harris on the forums, and he's also been on the show, that the full chronological cut of the movie, ordering the movies in the following order, I assume, 2, 1, and 3. It was, of course, in the big DVD box set, and it was also a more rare separate DVD release of the chronological cut over 2 discs. But again, I've not gotten confirmation that the Blu-ray box set does have the chronological cut, and I just have to find out for myself, because I'm ordering some stuff soon for work, and I've been eyeing the Blu-ray box set. So we'll see if it's in there, because I'd sit through that, because it's those movies that I like.
Yeah.
I mean, they might have just sort of pasted them together, and that's fine, because they don't need to like rearrange editing or anything. So they're all out there, and plenty of choice. And looking at the DVD versus Blu-ray comparisons in terms of image quality, it seems like a solid upgrade. I'll let you know when I do get the Blu-ray if they did include a chronological cut. And obviously, because it's not exclusive, there's exclusive material in it. Shit, I might even... I'm not even sure they feature the director's cut scenes in the chronological cut. So I'll report back to see what happens. But if you know, if you own the Blu-ray box set, listeners, do let us know if the full cut I Love a Godfather. Because didn't they do that with the Godfather as well? They assembled 1, 2, and 3 into one big movie. They were inspired, I suppose, by another series it's been compared to, by cramming them all together into a 6-hour experience or whatever. Okay, Phil, we are done. So we'll see what you and I get up to next, if we're going to get back to Alan Tam crapping or if there's other things to talk of. But there's endless Hong Kong cinema out there, so obviously there are other things to talk of.
Yes, yes.
Have you had anything on your mind in terms of like, I'd like to talk about that movie. Will Ken approve of it, though?
No, God, you know, I'm always pleasantly surprised on the choices that you pick. And like you say, there is a...
That's code for befuddlement, people.
Yeah, I'm befuddled by that. And
China Strike Force?
Yeah, huh? What?
Huh? What the hell is that? That's
no,
cool. That's cool, you know, motherfucker.
Yeah,
that's...
exactly. And you touch on... things that sometimes are outside of my comfort zone, which I don't mind at all. I'm always interested to see what we'll do next. And like I say, there's a billion different films we can go after. So yeah, we'll just see what comes on the horizon.
Absolutely, absolutely. But there for now, this has been Podcast on Fire on what was the first movie? Fearless Hyena. Already forgotten about it. I'm feeling so much feelings for Andy Lau now.
Yes.
And his performance and him as a person and the character. But Fearless Hyena and Infernal Affairs 3 was the content of this episode of Podcast on Fire, and we are located on podcastonfire.com. Plenty of choices, including bonus episodes, so make a choice over there and let us know if you have any questions or feedback on the following email, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. And follow the buttons leading to our social media, such as Facebook and Twitter, and follow the button to our iTunes feed, which you can rate, you can subscribe to, and you can leave a comment on our iTunes feed. And also Stitcher Radio, that's the final button on our website that will lead you to their website where you can stream our shows, but you can also do so from the application available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. And I review both these kind of movies, Fearless Hyena and Infernal Affairs, over at SoGoodReviews.com, and my video hub is SleazyKVideo.com, and my Twitter handle is at SoGoodReviews. Phil Boy.
Yes, you can find us at EasternFilmFans.co.uk, also on Facebook and Twitter, and you can bookmark us on your mobile.
Let me ask you about that, because of course you can go to easternfilmfans.co.uk on your mobile browser, but what's the advantage of being mobile that you're so damn proud of?
Oh,
I'm so dismissive.
Dismissive. Look, I'm in the modern world, I'm mobile. No, I think it's just because I do a lot of updates on Facebook and Twitter, and there's always something, you know, I'm retweeting, you know, other sites' information about Asian films, and I'm, you know, updating Facebook quite a bit more than the main site, because I get news in and I just want to share it with everybody rather than having to write posts, put it on site. So the mobile is great. You bookmark it and all the recent, you know, updates from Twitter and Facebook are on there for everybody
to
read. So, you
know,
daily, there's daily updates on there, and not from my site, from other sites that I retweet and, you know, promote and everything else. So it's good, and it keeps everybody in the loop in what's going on with the Asian cinema world.
Oh. Right on. An assembled feed for all things Phil.
Exactly.
All right, Tom, buddy. Thank you very much for doing the show again and for doing the trilogy coverage with me. You did a splendid job, my friend, and I enjoyed the discussions very much. I can put pressure on myself because I wanted them to feel right. Like I wanted, because when you're passionate about something, this is my problem. Sometimes I can't get it out in a coherent way. I just go like, oh, wow, oh my God. and sometimes I had to struggle through these three movies, the Infernal Affairs once, to make it come out coherent. And I know it's okay, but passion is sometimes something where I go like, I go all gaga over something.
It's good.
It's a challenge, though. It's a creative challenge, but I think we did good, Phil, and thank you for pulling off the coverage with me.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And so, yeah, this has been Podcast on Fire, and I've been Kenny B. And with me was Phil G of EastonFilmFans.co.uk on mobile. So say goodbye, buddy.
Goodbye, bye.